Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to our weekly podcast with Kevin Van Trump. I'm Todd Leckler, your co-host, and we're looking forward to a lot of good subjects today to touch on. Kevin, how you doing this morning, brother?
All right, still down in the back, battling that steroids up today. If that don't work, I guess I'm going to try a shot or something and get this MRI. But, yeah, back's kicking my ass, so we'll see what happens.
There ain't nothing worse than just chronic pain, brother. I feel for you, so I hope you get that figured out. Well, hey, man, you got anything happen over the weekend that I didn't talk about real quick before we jump into corn, bean, and wheat?
I mean, just the normal.
Yeah,
We can get to the geopolitical stuff. You going to get to the macro stuff in a minute?
Yeah, we'll do that. I was just talking about, I didn't know if you had anything exciting on your personal side. I'm sorry.
No, I'm down the back. Can't even do anything, man. I can't even.
All right, you can still get on the line and do some online auction. I know you. So anyway.
Yeah, well, I did some of that. Yeah, I have been buying some Randall knives and a few other buoys and stuff. So
right.
Seems like that buoy market's kind of gotten hot on some of the knife markets. So, yeah, we've been. I've been putting some money working in that space on the collector knife side. Man, kind of cool.
We'll touch more on that in a minute. Well, let's dive in, brothers. I know not a lot of new exciting news since report, but give us your corn, bean, and wheat.
Corn, I'm sitting here holding the bearish position. I own quite a few puts still. They're in the money. They're profitable. Like I said, I mean, if you held a gun to my head, I'd probably say we trade sub $4 before we trade over $4.50 again. And like I said, I'm not saying we're going to stay down there. We're just in this little period here where you got, like I said, the USDA dropped the kind of bearish bomb on us last week. And now we're sitting here at over 2.2 billion bushel carry, which I was worried could happen. And here we are. And, you got South American weather's pretty good. And the USDA already has our demand, penciled in at pretty high levels. We have good demand, but we're already estimating pretty good demand to get to the 2.2. So, I sit here right now, Todd, and like you said, we're kind of in a, I always call it a headline vacuum or a news vacuum during this period of time. The U.S. crop's out of the ground. South American weather doesn't seem to be much of an issue. We're waiting to get to the U.S. spring weather problems, possibly, or Brazil second crop weather concerns. And while we're in that news vacuum, it's tough to keep the bulls fed. And as I've said it for years, bull markets need, the bulls need to be fed regularly. Bears don't need to feed as much. I mean, bears can just continue to recite, hey, we're oversupplied, and that's enough to kind of pressure the market. Now, there's one wild card, I guess, because the funds are holding bearish positions in corn. If you were to get more of a macro lift, like say crude oil just takes off aggressively to the upside. Well, yeah, I think you could see the funds shift around a little bit and become more bullish corn, beans or wheat, as far as that goes, and provide us a nice short covering rally. And that's what I'd be looking for if I'm a producer. That's where I'm going to want to be making some sales. We have resting sale orders out there still from the rally that occurred. We haven't really adjusted those. I think there's a chance. Like I said, you get the funds to shift gears a little bit and become more bullish overall commodity space and get a little bit of weather problem in Brazil for second crop beans or maybe a weather scare here in the U.S. into early planting. So I'm going to try and get – my goal is to get another 10-20% of our 2026 priced. I got decent sales on right now. We sold about 20% there at that 460, 470 area. I haven't sold anymore. I'd like to get to 30 to 40% sold price before planting. So I'm keeping an eye on it. If you look out there, Deese is currently trading Deese 26. It's at 450. So it's not a bad number. It's not a bad spot. I think I had some sale targets out there closer to, 490, 480 to $5. And that may be a little struggle here, nearby, but as far as the 2025 crop, we're 60-65% sold in there. So I'd like to get at least maybe another 10% done before we plant here, and that'd give me about 30-40% to price into the U.S. growing season. So that's where we're at in the corn. You been hearing anything on your end, Todd?
No. Everybody just, we're going to hear lots of things, man, waiting for the next opportunity basis. I mean, there may be some local opportunities for guys. But I guess my only message is when these things happen, you got to jump and be ready to go, because too many times we've seen these people miss it. Even the ones that you sold last fall, I mean, guys, you know, messed around and didn't hit it. Now here they are, deer in the headlights. So move, yeah. Move when it goes.
And it's kind of the same story with beans, right? I mean, the question is what headlines are going to come out in the next couple, 3-5 weeks that, you know, that they're already harvesting beans in Brazil. I mean, they're probably, 3-5% harvested somewhere in that area around there. And it's, you know, hell, the crop's getting bigger, not smaller. Bumping the yields up. The USDA bumped it, from 175 to 178. Most everybody inside the trade's talking 180 plus now, you know, maybe 180 to 185. So, you know, the Brazilian crop looks like it's getting bigger, not smaller. Argentina production's, you know, probably going to be stable right about where it's at. The talk here is that we're going to have more bean acres. So, you know, here we sit. Well, what's really going to be the catalyst? China has already bought the beans. They kind of, you know, are close to completing. I suspect it's already complete or close to complete on what they agreed to. And here we are. The USDA bumped ending stocks, 60 million bushels higher. You know, we jumped from 250, around, what was it, 253? No, we're up to 350. And it's like I said, it's the same exact story. I was lucky, I guess, and we sold out of all of our beans on that rally north of $11. And I just was happy to get it above $11 average this year for beans. And that's, you know, that's kind of our saving grace, I guess. I have no positions on currently in the bean market. We were short there for quite a while. I took some small profits. I mean, I didn't make a whole lot of it. I made a little bit. I should have stayed in the position longer, but we're on the sideline. You know, I don't know if we'll see a nine handle in front of beans, because if you're looking at them right here and everything that's stacked up and lined up, I mean, we're just not breaking the bean market all that much. You know, it's just not all that big of a break. So could we drift down to 10-20? Probably. We get down to around 10-20, somewhere in there, maybe 10-10. So, I mean, I may look to re-own a little bit of 2025 production. I typically don't do that very often, but, you know, I think there's a chance you get a weather issue. You get some things passed here with policy. I mean, you can pop this thing to the upside. So, you know, I'm not super bearish beans, even though the balance sheet and the global balance sheet is extremely burdensome, especially the world balance sheet. I mean, you're almost, I think you're near, or you are at a record high global ending stock. So, you know, like I said, I'm not super bearish. We are, but I'm talking from a position where we're already sold out of all of our beans. And, you know, I'm looking to price some 2026 on the rally. Like, again, we got 20% price. I'd like to get that closer to 30-40% by planning, but I'm just going to be patient here and see if we can't get, you know, some type of pop to the upside on maybe the funds wanting to, like I said, get more bullish the overall commodity sector, or maybe some headlines come out that are, you know, maybe more pro-bullish, some type of demand here domestically or globally. I like the demand story. I think eventually the demand story is going to drive bean prices higher. It's just, you know, what do we do between now and then? We probably chop sideways to lower is my guess. But again, it doesn't look like they want to pressure this market real aggressively to the downside. So, you know, I'm just sitting here right now. Like I said, lucky, we kind of feeling blessed we sold out where we did, and just taking a wait and see approach. Now I got a lot of time on the clock now.
I'm gonna interrupt you. You keep saying lucky, dude. I mean, I've watched you for 10 years. I've watched other people for 10 years. You executed. You had a plan. You made the smartest decision. So you call it lucky. I know you're humbly, dude, but smart play, and everybody sees that in hindsight. So good for you.
Well, I appreciate it, but nobody likes to hear that shit. You know, I listen to all kinds of people through the years on trading marketing. It's just like, man, nobody wants to hear that you made a good, you know, because I make tons of bad calls too. So I got to tell everybody, I'm never going to sell the top, and I'm never going to probably sell the bottom. But, and we try to just, you know, be somewhere in between with some mostly try to stay above ground with some profitable years. And I think we've done that, you know, fairly well. So yeah, I'm not out here too far, that's for sure.
I know. What do you got on wheat? Not much happened there.
Yeah, I want to get bullish wheat. I mean, they're knocking the hell out of it again a little bit today. Well, they're down 8 cents, 10 cents. But, you know, I think they get this soft red below $5. I'm probably going to start dipping a little toe in and then becoming bullish tomorrow. You know, as Andy and a lot of my other trader friends will say, I'm always bullish wheat, and maybe, I don't know. I don't feel like I am, but I probably made more money on the long side of wheat than I have being bearish wheat. I would say that, but through the years, you know, like I said, I think there's still a lot of things happening in Ukraine, with Ukraine and Russia. There are reports over the weekend that a lot more ships, pretty much the majority of the ships, aren't wanting to go into the port of Odessa. Just too risky. There's a lot more, you know, escalation to the war. We also have a lot of geopolitical balls, and it's kind of a good segue into talking geopolitics. I mean, you got Trump making the Greenland push, saying that he'll use military if needed. You've got the Venezuela issues. You got issues in Iran. You've got things brewing. Typically, throughout my career, when the world feels like there's a lot of tension, or there could be military tension between some of the bigger players, they tend to get a little more aggressive in loading up and buying wheat for their countries. That's the wheat importers. Because the last thing they want to do is be caught short wheat with a lot of crazy military type action taking place out in the oceans or in certain key areas. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see an uptick in some buying of wheat from some of these other nations if they're low on supply. The problem is you got India sitting here right now. I mean, India would typically at times have been a big buyer. Well, shit, they're looking to export again. You know, and we're so flush. We've had such great weather these last couple years globally for wheat. And you guys have seen the production numbers just continue to push higher. We're just at a burdensome level on wheat global stocks. So the funds are aggressively short. The big play, I mean, my play of being a buyer down here is just trying to catch a short covering rally. Maybe we pop at 30 to 50 cents. And, you know, same way as a producer, that's probably where I'm looking to feather in some more sales. You get a 50 to 60 cent pop from some short covering rally. I probably feather in a few more sales and see if you can keep the momentum moving. But like I said, I don't know if we'll get the headlines. What I'm hoping is we get some geopolitical headlines that reverse the funds between now and, say, March. And if that can keep the market rallied, maybe then we get some northern hemisphere weather problems as we move closer to spring. Start talking about drought. You got some dry conditions, hard red winter wheat areas here at home. You've got some other areas and pockets around the globe. If you get a drought set in, or maybe some more worrisome weather, and the funds are blowing out of their shorts at the same time the weather starts to pop. Now we got something, and maybe we pop this wheat market a buck or so. Like I said, those would be probably the only things. If those don't come to fruition, funds stay short, no real geopolitical risk, weather looks like it's going to cooperate, well, shit, we grind sideways or lower. And, you know, that's the fear. And so that's how we're positioned and playing it. So we're going to kind of – I'm hoping Feb, March, April gives us a better time window, or, you know, a better window of time to do some of our wheat marketing. So that's kind of where I'm at right now in that time.
Yeah, and you touched on the geopolitical balls in the air and stuff, and let's move to the economic side of things. I mean, what's with all this going on, Fed meeting next week, and even though the market says we're not going to make any more cuts, I mean, just kind of put some pieces in play what you see this doing potentially for the economy and any rollover effects that might have for things as you see the pieces.
On the geopolitical risk you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, with all the stuff going there, I mean, with the tariffs that they're 10% tariffs going to put on, up on the 25 here in February. I mean, is this going to reignite inflation? Just a quick overview on from the macroeconomic viewpoint with all the geopolitical pieces moving.
Well, we always say, I mean, the economy is not the stock market, but right. Again, though, we saw what happened the first time President Trump came out and announced all the big tariffs. Shit, we broke the market, what, almost 20%, right? 15%, something like that. So I don't know. I mean, if people get spooked and they're scared, they're going to take the money off the table. I always tell, you know, we always know. I mean, you don't have massive breaks in the market when the market's overbought. You get massive breaks in the market when the market gets oversold. And, you know, and that could happen, I guess, if everybody gets spooked enough. I mean, I suspect if we end up getting in some type of war with Europe or some type of, you know, NATO gets blown apart here, I mean, I suspect you could see people get spooked a little bit. That's why I said last week, if you read the report, I mean, I'm not, again, I'm not saying this position ends up right or anything else. I was out there selling 7,500 S&P calls in June. So I sold the S&P 500, 7,500 calls in June. I was using some of that money to buy puts. I was also banking some profits, as I wrote in a report. I banked some profits on the financial sector, banked some profits and some other things last week. Just kind of lightened up a little bit. Moved more cash to the sideline. Just, you know, just because of this. Like I said, I'm not saying we end the year necessarily negative territory, but I certainly believe the waters are ripe to have some extreme volatility. And so at any point in time this year, could we see a 10, 15, maybe even a 20% pullback? Certainly, why not? And, you know, so I'm just kind of positioned myself to add on those types of breaks. I'm not chasing the market higher. I'm just going to be looking to add on the bigger breaks. And I'm not going to add like crazy either. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not going all in or anything on these breaks. So, you know, that's really how I'm looking to play it, Todd. And I think the president has a lot more things on his agenda, and the conditions, like I said, the underlying environment and landscape of conditions could warrant some people getting a little spooked. And when people get spooked, they pull the money, right? And you get that knee jerk to the downside. So, and I think that's probably just the opposite of what you're seeing in the gold and silver and the metals market, correct? Like,
absolutely.
People are pumping a little more money in. This is adding fuel to the fire. You know, originally we talked and we said it's mostly the central banks that are trying to divest out of dollar-denominated assets into more like gold. But now, you know, you do have – this is going to fuel your inflation bugs. It's going to fuel your people that think the world's coming to an end, or this is the grand finale. And, you know, all your doomsdayers. And this is going to drive more interest into that camp. So, you know, I was looking for a pullback as well as you were, Todd. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe that doesn't happen. Maybe gold and silver just keep on trucking for a little while. I'm still sitting on quite a bit. Like I said, I was trying to sell. I'm trying to sell most of my physical silver. Haven't gotten that done. I saw that the mint came out over the weekend and raised their prices. You know, they jumped their prices on some of their uncirculateds and all that from, I think it was like 91, 92 bucks an ounce up to 173 or 171 an ounce on some of their uncirculated. And some of their, you know, that's some of their, like those collector things they sell and things like that. That doesn't mean you're going to be at 171 an ounce, but it definitely means they think that price could stay higher for longer, or could stay higher for longer. So it's interesting to see that play. I don't know what all that means, you know, like I said, longer term. I'm trying to feather in some sales on the rallies. It looks, sure in the hell looks to me like the silver bulls definitely want to test 100. I think they may knock on the door four or five times, maybe pull back a little, and then I think maybe we break out and push through it, I guess, if so, that's certainly what it looks to be, you know.
I mean, so then if you were to put it in one of these three categories, you know, fear trade, the dollar trade because it's weak, or just liquidity trade, I mean, can you put it in one of those camps, or is it not? Is that
– what are you talking about?
For the metals, gold, you know, in the metal trade.
Right? No, like I said, I think it was central banks trying to get out of dollar denominated asset, and that was what has driven it. I think you have a little bit of a lack of supply in the market right now, and I think you've got, like I said, you got the fear traders, you got the inflation traders, you got the sky is falling people, you got the, you know, you just the momentum players, you got the people that were probably chasing a lot of the meme stocks and all that craziness. Well, they're in chasing it because it's a momentum play. So you got the Momo traders in, and you got all the traders in. I mean, everything's kind of right. And hell, you got gold up, what, another 145 bucks an ounce today, and silver's up another 5,000 an ounce. It's nuts. And I the volatility is going to be, you know,
extreme. Yeah.
I mean, you know, trading it future, I mean, you can get your face ripped off in a hurry. So I'm just sitting here watching, trying to feather in some sales as we continue to rally. I've actually looked, there's a couple of things. Couple of gold pieces I'm looking at, or a few different ones. I've been buying some older gold, real older gold, Todd. So like gold that was minted, I shouldn't say minted, it was smelted in like 1800s, anywhere from 1870s, or maybe 1860s to about 1880, 1890. from some of those California mines and some of those other mines out west. If you can buy them now and not pay the juice on them being kind of a, you know, a collector's item, and you can get them damn near at cost, spot. And, you know, if you can buy it at spot and you think gold's a long, long, longer term play, and you can go ahead and get in some of the collector premium here, it hadn't been too bad. So I am looking at a few of those pieces, not really on the silver side, but more the gold side.
How does that open up to you? I mean, somebody say something to you, buddy, bring it up, or where'd you go down that
trail? Well, you know, well, just a lot of different places. So Jordan and I will travel around. We go to those Great Civil War show up in Illinois, where there's a lot of cool stuff. There's a, you know, that Tulsa, world's largest gun show down there in Tulsa. But it's not just guns. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's filled with a lot of things, Indian artifacts, you know, a lot of Civil War things, a lot of antique stuff, you know, that were in back in. And so, yeah, you know, and just, then you meet the right guys, and then they kind of turn you on to things, and that's kind of their specialty. And there were a few different gold and silver specialty people that Jordan and I have met at different shows across the country here in the last few years that specialize in kind of that collector stuff. So, yeah, something different.
So, so the old adage is true, whether we're talking about our conferences or whatever, you got to get out and meet people, expand the network, expand the knowledge.
Yeah.
And it opens doors.
But yeah, these last couple of years, I mean, Jordan and I have learned so much on the, whether it's cowboy shooting or just the Wild West stories and Wild West history from getting out and meeting some of the absolute leaders in the industry. So, you know, and we've hit it off with a few good people. Yeah, you know, they've all given us the books they've written and you know, stay in contact, tell us a lot of cool things. And so, yeah, that was I think Jordan just purchased that gun that JFK had owned that had come up through the pipeline. So, you know, Jordan's got all kinds of different guns that are owned, Elvis, JFK, a bunch of different people. So he's kind of into a lot of that stuff. But, yeah, I love the history. You'd really like this gun, Ty. I mean, it came with like a whole damn notebook on this history. So pretty cool.
I just want to make that point. I mean, that's probably one thing more farmers could probably do to help themselves out is just get out, meet people. You can't do that behind your desk.
Well, like Jordan said, the last two trips we went on, they were both at the one was the big gun and knife show down there, and the other one was a big, like, Civil War antique. But we went, and we spent the whole time together. It was just me and him. I think one of the guys at the conference in Kansas City told me, he came, and he comes each year with his son, and they own a big ag retail company. But he's like, hell, it's probably the only time we spend 5 hours together in the truck.
Exactly.
Talk a lot about business, talk a lot about life, spend time in the hotel. Just because when we're home, I mean, we're pretty much dug in. I mean, Jordan's got his family and his kid and his wife, business, and I've got mine. And, you know, yes, we talk, but not a lot. You know, we don't have a lot of time. You might get 5, 10, 15 minutes here and there.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of what we do. And, but, you know, those trips are really good. So Jordan and I have committed to going to things that aren't business related, and it helps us get a broader perspective on other things. And I think it's good father-son time. And, you know, I've enjoyed it a lot. And I believe he has too. So, yeah, I'd encourage everyone to find some things like, and a lot of guys go hunting together, fishing together. But what I found is a lot of times I do those, I mean, there's lots of people involved usually, and there's multiple people. And these things, just kind of things Jordan and I like to do together, and that's what we do. Just it's him and I, and that's kind of what we do. So
yeah,
every time then the girls will go, but they'll kind of go off and do their own thing, you know. And we'll just meet back up together at night, but you know, so we it's nice to ride together and talk, and yeah, for sure.
Memories, education, and experiences, man, good stuff.
Yeah.
Let's jump into something we touched on in the report today. I mean, we know about the K-shaped economy. We know inflation's, I call real versus published, and things like that. But BlackRock chief Larry Fink came out and said, you know, capitalism must evolve. Everybody's over there at Davos doing their thing. And we've been seeing the undertones of this for some time, what AI is going to do and this and that. And obviously, we're seeing the social unrest from certain people saying that capitalism's got to go. But he made the statement, and I want to know what your thoughts are on it, that AI could do the same thing to white collar work that globalization did to blue collar, which, you know, didn't put the needs out, just changed where they got to, how they got taken care of. So, I mean, do you see that as a reality from where we're at so far?
You know, we always over forecast, right? What's going to happen?
Right, for sure.
the next 10 years and underestimate. Yeah, I mean, we underestimate longer term and overestimate short term. I got to believe it displaces workers. I mean, there's no question of that, especially initially. But it seems like we always end up finding other places where those workers are going to pick up and you know, migrate towards. That's kind of the problem, though. What do you tell your kids to be? You know, you go to college. I mean, like, that was always Jordan saying, hey, you know, I told Jordan, and keep in mind now, Jordan was a big, you know, sports guy, played all the sports and big jock guy. And he asked me what I thought, you know, he should go to school to be. And I said, yeah, hey, I think you need to get a degree in English or maybe history. You got to learn how to think. You got to learn how to think. And if you can learn how to think, nothing's ever going to outrun you. And that was something my grandfather taught. You know, he's like, no matter what, because he came from Germany. They took everything away from him. They came from the Depression where he lost everything there. You know, he's like, as long as you have the ability to think independently and think freely, I mean, it doesn't matter if you lose everything. You can bounce back. It doesn't matter if it takes, I mean, you can bounce back. And, you know, and that's really what I wanted the kids to do. I wanted them to learn how to be independent free thinkers and really learn how to learn. And so I felt, you know, rather than a business degree or some of the other specifics, I think you want to learn how to be a good thinker. And I don't think that's ever going to go out of style. And regardless of AI, I think with AI, it even becomes more and more important, right? I mean, because you're going to be trying to figure things out that the computer can't, and you're going to have the edge, and you're going to try and, you know, and I listened to that. I heard a lot of that, Todd, from Warren Buffett when he spoke when I was probably, oh shit, in the early 90s. And then I heard several other guys that made it big as investors. They said the same thing. They liked English. They liked history. They liked a lot of those things that just because we think technology is going to continue to advance faster and faster, and we're not being able to forecast and predict. So, you know, do I think nurses are going to stay? Oh, for sure. You know, I think nursing is going to always be. But doctors, I'm not sure. I think you're going to turn more and more of that over to AI. Maybe you have fewer doctors. And they're really good doctors, but maybe they're just fewer. Lawyers, maybe you have fewer. You know, I mean, they're going to weed some of those out, those entry positions. But you're going to always probably going to need a great trial lawyer. You're probably going to always need, you know, a great doctor that's a specialist. And that, like we heard the AI guy talk, his dad won all those awards because it was his bedside manner and how he made patients feel and how he treated them. I don't think AI is going to be able to provide that. So if you're someone that can provide that in a specialized field, well, shit, sky's the limit still. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to play out. Do I think we're going to see that pullback in employment? Yes, but I think then you're going to pick it up in other places. And I also think it's going to be wildly deflationary, not inflationary. So, you know, net, I don't know how that plays out for the economy.
No, it's going to be hard, though. But, I mean, how do we get ahead of the learning curve on, you know, what our kids need to be learning, like you were touching on, what, you know, this is going to change the future of education as we know it. I mean, a lot of people are already pushing, go out and get your, you know, your blue collar tech degree and figure out how to, you know, go that way, which sounds like there'll be a need for, but
maybe, right? But maybe. So play that out. So what, you're telling me in 5-10 years? I mean, there's not going to be AI, there's not going to be robots that are able to do, I don't know, plumbing, roofing. There's already kind of some robot roofing things. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I promise you this. You cannot lose becoming a good thinker.
No. So, absolutely.
I mean, you can still become a great thinker and then get out and go do HVAC work. I mean, what does that hurt you? I mean, hell, you'd be the best in the industry. I mean, don't put yourself above and beyond doing blue-collar work for certain. But if you become – and that's what I've always told Jordan. If Jordan weren't in this, I told Jordan, I said, hey, go start an HVAC company, go start a concrete business, do some flat work. Do, you know, whatever. Jordan's done all those things, and whether it was my family or, he worked flat work for years as a kid. So it's like, you know, I think there's great potential in blue collar space. Again, though, I think the key is going to be to outthink and outposition the competition. So you still need to be a great thinker. And I think you can get a lot of that by learning history, by learning, reading the classics, and just learning. You know, like, that was so far out of Jordan's wheelhouse, Todd, to get a degree in English.
Right. And this
was horrible at English. He didn't read very many books. All he did was play sports. And when I told him that, he's like, Dad, have you lost your mind? Like, there's no way. And I told you before, he called me about 2-3 weeks in. He's in a fraternity. He was the only kid in a fraternity I think that was in it had a degree in English. And he called me the first few weeks there, and he's like, Dad, this is ludicrous. He's like, I'm literally in class with these people who are eating up about Shakespeare, and they're smoking pipe, and they got on an Argyle sweater vest. And you know,
Fire
hearts, and looks like he dried off out of the woods. And I said, just hang in there, dude. Just hang in there. You're going to get some diversification. You know, you're going to get broadening perspective. And he made it through it. He did good. He got good grades. And like I said, he made it through it. And now he looks back now and he's like, shit, Dad, that's probably one of the best things you told me it is. Like it really sucked at the time, but I really did learn a lot. And I said to him, when in the hell would he ever in his life, Todd, you know, Jordan, and when would he ever have that kind of chance or opportunity to read those books? He would never have done that or learned that type of, he just wouldn't be around those type of people, right? So I thought that's right. What really worked well for him in college. I think too many people go to college and want to do what their friends do, and they want to get this degree in business degree, they want to get this degree like their friend. Well, shit, when you're doing more than doing what they're doing, that's just my theory. So I like to go and challenge themselves, you know, get outside their comfort zone, so.
Well, let me ask you, in addition to what you just said, what are very key and important, looking forward, do you still feel that the level of service matters? And what I'm getting at is this, because you used to tell me when you worked at a tire shop back, and when you got done with the car, I mean, you cleaned the car, you did this wash, whatever. And I'll take, we had it the other day, and, you know, took the car and had a tire, flat tire change. And I'm like, man, if they would have just done something like, you said, run it through a wash or clean the windows, you'd really feel good about it. And you'd always come back. But does service even matter anymore in regards to building the business or standing out?
I'm always going to say it matters. And I hate the word service, but hospitality certainly matters.
Right.
And, you know, Todd, when we sent out the letter that we're going to cut back to 3 days a week and then one day a podcast and this and that, told people, having some health issues, you got to work on this back thing, get it figured out. I got a couple things that I'm trying to, you know, just try to make the long run to live to be 80, 90 years old. But, you know, a lot of the letters that came in were just people being appreciative of how we made them feel. And, you know, and I think that's the key. I mean, a lot of people said made them feel like family. And, you know, we try to do that at FarmCon event. I try to do that when I go out and meet people or talk or go to other conferences. And, you know, I think treating people right is the key. I remember when I worked at the Board of Trade, there's several different instances. Hell, I remember when I worked at the in Chicago, when we got moved over, we were then off the floor, we were moved over to Sears Tire. Shit, I'd buy the guy breakfast there. I'd valet park my car there. See, it was just damn near as cheap to valet park your car at Sears Tire than it was to go park. So the doorman and the guys that would valet for me, I'd buy them breakfast, you know, 2-3 times a week. I'd, you know, get them tickets to things. And, you know, a lot of other people kind of treat them like shit, I thought. And then when I moved back to Kansas City Board of Trade, there was a janitor that worked at the whole Board of Trade, a black gentleman, and he was older. And, you know, a lot of guys just treated him like shit. And I remember one time I had a big spread in my office. We'd hit a big lick, and I'd ordered Gates Barbecue in, and I had tons of Gates Barbecue, and lots of the guys from the board were there and other people from the exchange. And they came in, and my janitor came in, and they were – a couple of them were like, hey, what are you doing, man? Like, this is a private event. This is not – you know, this is just for traders only, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I snapped and lost it a little bit. And, you know, I just said he was one of our friends, and we wanted to treat him like family. And I told them to get the hell back in line, and he's going before them. And that really pissed a few guys off. But, you know, nonetheless, it made my point. And, you know, and I just think you got to treat people right. And that has to be the play. And I tell Jordan that, and I tell my daughter that. And if you aren't going to treat people right and treat them like family, well, then you just don't need to be in that. You don't need to be in a business that is forward facing, you know. And that's how I feel about it. And, you know, it's not about anything, about anything. You got to have that, got to be in the playbook. And, you know, hospitality is, I think, always going to matter. At least it's always going to matter to me. Nothing worse than going through. I mean, I just get pissed when I go through a drive-thru.
I'm with you. I know.
And I'm like, look, you picked this job. And if you pick the job, hey, be happy. Do the best you can do at that job. And, I mean, well, I can tell you, I can't be more pissed. And if people are really nice and they're doing a great job, I tell them they're doing a great job, and you typically I give them a little extra money, you know. And I think that's all you can do. Unfortunately, I feel like a lot of kids just weren't taught well, Todd. I mean – My grandparents taught me all this. I mean, it was my grandparents mostly. You know, sit up straight. Take your hat off at the table. Don't do that. Put your knife on the side of the plate. Have proper manners. Don't have your elbow on the table. You know, wait for everybody to get to the table before you eat. I can't tell you how many places I go now, sit down and eat with people, and shit, they start eating. I mean, and the person that made the food ain't even to the table yet. And it's like, what the hell's going on here? You know, or then they get up before everybody's done and things like that. Yeah, I'd say that's a problem. But that's where I think if you're going to have, if you have those skills and your parents and people have taught you hospitality, boy, you're going to really win. Because, right, there's going to be less and less of those people around. So,
No question about it.
You gain a big edge, especially in business. And I think that's what the farm community would like to see. You know, a lot of these ag tech startups, they go running out there hot. They send people out in their white belt and some sports car and shit. I don't think they got any hospitality. I think they even know what hospitality means. And then, you know, come out and just trying to sell you shit. And I don't like it. And we don't do business with them. So, you know, I think it's a very, very, very important part. What did I just say? That doctor that won all his awards, he didn't win it because of he was kicking some major ass on the surgery. He won it because that way he made people feel. And, you know, and how you make people feel is always going to be important, in my opinion, and probably becomes more important with AI. So the humanity side, you know, I can't stress that enough. So,
yeah, and it's the last sentence. It's what people always remember, isn't it? How you made them feel, regardless of the outcome. So get rid of the transactional attitude and get into the hospitality for sure.
Yeah.
Let's move on for a second. Listen, we reported today that in that tweet, you know, there's now for the first the largest gap ever, 530,000 more sellers than buyers in the housing market right now. So just educate me a little bit. I was doing some reading trying to figure out, I mean, the reason option houses aren't selling, rates are still high and stuff, but how do we get the 10-year treasury, which, you know, is kind of the benchmark for mortgage rates, how do we get it down? I mean, if it stays high, then the rates are going to stay high, and if the dollar's not, the dollar's down, it's, I mean, play it out there. What do we got to do, man, to get these?
I mean, my stance is this. You can look at that data and think, oh, shit, we're going to be in a free fall. We're not going to be in a free fall. I mean, my opinion,
right.
I don't see we're in a free fall. And that, they're saying there's more sellers than buyers. They're full of shit because there's a ton of buyers. They're just not unlocked. I mean, everybody and their brothers went in to be buyers of houses, either on a price break or a break in interest rates. So it's like you got a shitload of buyers. I mean, that's why I don't think housing prices are going to move all that much. Maybe, again, sideways to slightly lower, maybe a touch, but you already have 20%. So what is it now? 20% of the mortgages are now 6% or higher, which is the first time. And then you got about 20% that are below 3%. So you got everyone kind of trapped in there. But the 20% that are above 6% over the last 3 years, things happen. Life happens, right? You get divorced, you have kids, you get transferred, you got this, you got that, people die. So people are still buying houses. You're not unlocked those people that have that sub 4% rate because you had the price escalation. With the rate escalation, well, they can't really move. You see what I'm saying? I mean, they can't afford, they can't upgrade their house to a bigger house. Because the cost is so much more and the rates are higher. So it's a double whammy. So they're kind of locked. You know, do I think interest rates are going to come down aggressively? No, President Trump's definitely trying to lean on that, which I like the idea. You know, I'd love to see the 30-year around 5%, maybe in 4.5%, you know, somewhere in 4.5 to 5.5%. I think you unlock a lot of pent-up buying.
But
do you really? I mean, if we unlock pent up buying, well, prices are going to go higher. That's what I keep trying to tell. I mean, we were buying. You know, we tried to. We were buying low balling, and there, you know, a year or two ago, when some people were getting nervousy about things, and we picked up a few. I just think prices are going to keep going higher because if you unlock the buying, well, holy shit! I mean, we're going to have a buying frenzy again. We're going to get back to that shit where we were bidding up how, you know, your people are paying over. There's still some people paying over, which is crazy to me, but you know, I still see listings come up in and around our area on farm ground or on some nice ranches or some nice, you know, bigger hunt. I mean, there's still people bidding up on certain properties and getting in bidding. It seems crazy, but that's what I'm saying. I think if you can pick something up, you can lowball somebody that's in a jam, I think you want to be a buyer, but
right.
I am talking my position now, so keep that in mind.
Well, let's dive into some business insights and stuff. We had a great article today, and it was at the FarmCon where Barrett talked about flow on the panel on growing and your business and such. But tell us a little bit about what flow means, how it affects company culture, and then just on the company culture, because we kind of touched on with hospitality, but I know you were big on that, learning about it, helped Jordan understand it and help other CEOs understand it. But touch on this flow thing real quick, what it meant, what it means.
Well, I'd say if you didn't watch the video, that's one thing you should probably do is Barrett explained it.
Right.
To
need to watch the video.
I thought he nailed that one. And, you know, just for us, it's always been the same thing. Whether it's politics or whether it's at the office or at the work, I tell the kids and I tell everybody, I mean, focus on what you're for, not what you're against. And you know, like politics, man, I get so sick and tired of hearing all my friends. We play poker every week, and I get so tired of hearing everybody come out and bitch, and all they do is bitch, and it's always what they're against. Who gives a shit what you're against? I'm so tired of hearing it. Go out and do something on what you're for. Nobody does that. Everybody sits around and bitches, and it's shit. And I mean, go out and be what you're for, and do something about what you're for. And you're not, if you're a heavy right person, you're not, I don't think you're about just annihilating and killing the left. I mean, so go out and do what you're for with the right. I mean, go out there. If you're against abortion, go out and, you know, do your thing to be against abortion. If you're for gun rights, go out and march for gun rights. It isn't go attack the other people and spend all your time on the negative shit. So when you're a business leader, I tell Jordan, and this is what Barrett explained, try to stay in flow. Try to stay in what your vision is for the positive. I mean, what's your journey? What if your goal is to go from 5 million to 10 million, or you want to go from 25 million to 100 million? Okay, you got to map out how you're going to get there. You're going to have to stay in the flow of the water. So everybody that's throwing pebbles in, as Barrett would explain, those are your people on your team that are throwing in monkey wrenches, constantly just throwing shit in that you have to deal with. They have millions of excuses. They lie to you about things. They do shit and it tears stuff up. So you're spending all your time over here dealing with problems. Okay, you got to get rid of those people. You got to get rid of those people, and you got to get different people that can stay with you in your vision and with your flow. And you know, and that's really it for us. We're trying to get our staff right over there on Jordan's business, and you know, he's gone through a few people. They probably. You know, they're probably up to about 20 people on staff now, and he's probably had about, I think he's turned over 7-8 people. But, boy, the last person we had to get rid of, that Jordan got rid of, excuse me, he was always telling me all these problems. This guy was just paying the ass. But he was a hard worker. You know what I mean? The guy worked his ass off when he worked, but gosh damn, there was a ton of drama that came with it and a ton of problems, nonstop, always. Well, Jordan Vent finally just had enough and fired the guy. They got kind of some pissing at Jordan fired him. And several of the guys at the office that are my friends, the older guys that worked there with Jordan, they said, boy, that guy was a hard worker, but I'm telling you what now. The office is so much better and the environment is so much better that he's gone. We're doing more production now than we ever were then. And the guy was one hell of a hard worker. So I'm just telling you, I know it's scary to get rid of a guy that is doing a lot of the hard work. But my gosh, how much more enjoyable is life and business when you get everyone kind of going on the same page that aren't throwing the pebbles and blocking the damn flow of the water. So, you know, get a vision. Where's your flow going? Which way do you want your water to flow? And then anybody that comes in and impedes the flow of that water, you got to get rid of them. You just got to get rid of them and try to move. That's just where we're at. And try to stay focused. Don't let people pull you over there to where that's all you're focusing on is the damn pebbles and the rocks that are damming up the flow of the water. And you'll get there too. Trust me, throughout my entire career in life, I oftentimes find myself in that mindset. And I don't know how the hell I got there. I think I just got there. I got pulled over there by those people. But you can't allow it. And Todd, I think you got there in your other career and you got frustrated in your profession and other things, and everybody does. And you can't, I don't know if you can help it. You just get there, but you got to recognize to pull yourself out. So,
well, I was going to add the unspoken truth about what you said in regards to, as an owner, a manager, until you turn the reins over to your right hand man. Or, I mean, you got to put the time and effort in to establish that culture stuff. Because I remember one of my weaknesses was having that third assistant position. You worked all the crappy hours. You needed them, but you knew you were going to lose them because you're always looking for a better job. But if you had a culture established, we knew that he would have something internally to look to and stuff. So it's important to set the tone as the leader, put the work and time and effort in, and it's like an annuity, man. Then it's running itself, and you just keep your eye on it and stuff. But if you don't, I ain't saying nothing nobody don't know. It's paying ass running through employees and not getting it right.
Yeah.
And then worried about it.
And as you know, I've struggled my whole life in building good quality teams just because I always tell everyone, I think I always took the mindset, you should be willing to work as hard as I am, do as what I'm willing to do. And if you're not, well, you know, shit, you're out. And that's bad. That's a tough mindset. And you got to be able to build a good quality team and have a great culture. And like I said, something I was never probably really able to do. I'd probably be a great, like I told you, a great number two or three guy for someone. I'm going to work my ass off and I'm going to just grind it and everything. But I'm not real rah-rah guy. I'm not real, hey, let's all come in and kumbaya and have a big hug and let's sit around and roast some marshmallows yet. I just never was. You know, my grandpa just told me, be a hard worker, just go out there, work my ass off, and in exchange for that work, the gentleman, farmer, he going to give me some money. And be grateful that he gave me some money and just keep working my ass. And that's really all I needed. And I thought that's what other people would do as well, but it isn't, obviously. In today's world, they need a lot of the rah-rah stuff and a lot of all that. And I'm just not that guy. And I bet a lot of my friends out there really aren't either. And when you're not that, it's tough to build a big team. I mean, you're going to have to do a lot of the hard work yourself. And you may get one or two loyal guys that kind of see things like you or gals and knows who you got to run with. And that's what I've done. I'm with Todd and Stacy and my family. And my family has the same work ethic I have. And that's, you know, and that's probably why a lot of folks like to have their family on board. So. Like I said, it is the hardest thing I know to do in business is to build a good quality team and have a great culture. Everybody talk about that shit and how easy it is. Well, I'm telling you, sure in hell ain't easy for me. So.
No, you're. I like to call you Jason Bourne. You're out there making crap happen on your own, pal. You're not Douglas MacArthur leading men into battle. Not yet, anyway. So.
Yeah, I'm not that good. Like I said, when I was captain of the team or anything, you know, in sports, the coach, I say, you know, you got something to say, hey, give us a speech. You know, I didn't want to say anything, and it's kind of like me getting nervous because I just wasn't that guy. It's like, great, 1, 2, 3, win. I mean, you know, I had nothing. I mean, let's go out there and kick shit out of them. Everybody do their job, and let's win this game and go home and go to the next thing. So, you know, I was just more all business. And
yep.
I didn't need that. I didn't need someone else motivating me to get me going. And that, I think, makes it tough to build a team, you know, because then you're kind of that jackass kind of, you know, I'm not calling myself a jackass, but I'm saying – a lot of these younger people don't like working for me or with me because I think they think I'm an asshole. You know what I'm saying? Like the guy just works all the time. He's all bit. Well, I mean, yeah. I like to work done and then go home, spend time with my family and my kids and things like that. So yeah, I'm all in. And then, you know, and that's how it is. So on the work side.
Yeah. Well, definitely. If you're a subscriber and didn't watch that video, definitely need to do that. Well, hey, let's wrap it up with the final question in regards to, just anything that happened in your week that we don't know about, that maybe insightful calls, meetings, or anything you're reading, or, you know, something that caught your mind this week.
No, I've been on a few different business calls with some companies that are in ag, struggling, you know, more startup phase, let's call it, you know, been in business 1 to 7 years, somewhere in there, and, you know, just struggling and trying to figure it out. And been on a few of those calls the past few days and different board calls, and it just comes back to the same thing. You really got to have a game plan. You got to know what that game plan are you looking, you know, the first thing you got to ask yourself in any business, even on your farm, are you looking for an exit? And if you're not looking for an exit and then it's a legacy play, well, those are two different ways to build businesses. Building a business looking for an exit requires X, X, and X, right? And in these certain steps, building a business for a legacy play is an entirely different animal. I think oftentimes people get those thoroughly mixed up. meaning you think you're building for a legacy play, but the rest of the family's building for an exit, or is going to be looking for an exit. And or you're taking a bunch of money, and your investors would like to see an exit, but you're the owner, and now you're looking for a legacy play. Well, shit. I mean, everybody's on different pages. And like I said, those are wildly different animals. You got to think about them differently. You got to put your steps in place differently. And, you know, you have to make that type of transition. So that's a lot of the things I've been working through with some of the CEOs or owners. And, you know, what exactly is your goal? And a lot of times they're not really, you know, they've gotten themselves into a position now where it's become their baby. Originally, they were looking to build a business and sell a business, and now it's kind of become their baby, and now they're like, eh, maybe we're not going to sell the business. So, I don't know. I think that's tough for people. I think that becomes tricky and becomes difficult. And, you know, then you got to kind of move to the rears and reposition yourself and then go back into battle. But, you know, if I could tell anybody, even on the farm, like I said, I saw an interesting tweet out there, Todd. Those people were talking, you sent me that one about $70,000 an acre, right? Would you sell the farm, right?
Right.
Okay. I saw somebody put out there, you know, what if you were offered $200,000 an acre? Would you sell the family farm business? Shit, there were tons of people out there saying no, no way. And, you know, it's interesting to me. I mean, it's interesting. I understand it may be where your dad was born, his dad and his dad and his dad. And that's fine. Then you're definitely... You ain't selling for 200,000 acres. I mean, you are definitely building a legacy business. And, boy, I'd be doing all kinds of cool things to insulate that and make sure that legacy continued and, you know, just being a visionary on the forefront of what I can do with my land and how I'm going to use this land all different ways. And, you know, as things evolve and times change, and if that's your play, I mean, you know, versus I have some other friends who are easily – you know, they're going to be a seller at 50,000 there. Shit, they're probably a seller at 40,000 there. But they're taking that money then. They're investing it into some type of dynasty trust. The money is going to stay in play for generations to come. Spin off a lot of the kids, you know, money for various businesses they may have better or more interest in. Or things they are interested in and things. So I just think that's where it becomes, you know, what exactly are you trying to do? And what, you know, what, are you trying to preserve the past or are you trying to build the future? I don't know. And I think that's a different question for everyone. For me, I'm trying to help my kids build a future. I'm not looking to preserve my past or my legacy. It's I believe my time here is to try and help them and help them move the ball forward. And I'm hoping they have the same attitude towards with their kids and help their kids move the ball forward, and whatever that may be. If my kids have no interest in agriculture, so be it. You know, they've got to take the ball and move the ball their direction the best they can, try and accumulate what they can accumulate as far as some assets and pass those on to their kids to allow their kids to do the best they can do in their lane. So, you know, that's the way we look at it. But I'm telling you, there's a ton of people out there that haven't really determined if they're building a business to sell a business or they're building the business as a long, long-term dynasty legacy play.
It sounds to me, Ken, like we could make a segment out of that for just a checklist and stuff. That's good. That's good information. People need to think about that kind of deal.
Yes.
Then we need to make sure Henry doesn't become the weak link there. Remember what they talk about, third generation, after you build successful businesses. You got to train Henry up properly, too. So he don't,
yeah, yeah.
He don't,
well, that's why I didn't want Jordan or Kennedy to come into my business.
So no, right, I got you.
I allowed them to. I said, you got to find your own thing, and you got to do your own thing. And you got to find, you know, you're going to be the one here navigating, and I'm going to be gone. And so I can't ask them to navigate and do something that just because I wanted to do it. So,
no. Hey, I meant to ask you one question real quick, easy one, and I'm going to ask you again next week. But because I know we're getting near time when you start sharing your thoughts on locking in some diesel. We got any comments now, or do we need to wait for that?
Well, we already locked in some quite a bit earlier, remember, on the big price
break. That's right, he did. Okay. Well, I know February 14th always.
And I said I'm going to jump the gun here quite a bit. So we did, just on some of those threats that happened with us, with some of the other. You know, if you haven't, I wouldn't be opposed to seeing it.
Yeah.
I think the risk is could we go to $40 a barrel? We're sitting here saying $60 a barrel crude. Can you 40? Yeah, I think. But could you go to 100? shit, I guess the thing's really cut loose. So, you know, you got to mitigate that risk. And so, you know, you probably want to have about 50% locked in, because I think you could go to $40 fairly easily if things go okay. If things get rocked, shit. I mean, the risk like to the upside. So, you know, you're getting closer to where we like to around that Valentine's period. I like it. And I've seen some of that floating around, haven't we? I think I've seen some other folks, right?
Yeah.
Lock in deals. So I'd get with your local supplier, see what you can lock in. Probably if you haven't, I would. We lock in a little better price than where we're currently at. But, hey, I'm not opposed to locking in a little bit more as things look like they're escalating geopolitically. So, yeah, makes some sense.
All right. Well, listen, man, I appreciate your time today. I know you've been struggling with your back. I'll get that thing looked at and look forward to chatting next week, brother.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you. See you.
Take care. Bye. Bye.